and welcome to the Locust Roundtable podcast. Today we are recording at ReaderCon in Burlington, Massachusetts, and we're sitting here today with Vandana Singh, if you could say hello.
Hi.
And also with Anil Menon.
Hello.
Who have been the co-editors of Breaking the Bow, an anthology of short fiction based on the Ramayana sagas. And I was wondering if you guys could start out a little bit talking about what you were going for with that anthology and how it came into being.
Okay. So basically started when we did this workshop at IIT Kanpur. It's a technology institute, and it's perhaps India's best technology institute. And we had done this Clarion-type workshop, which is about for 3 weeks. We had different instructors every week. And I think Vandana taught the third week. I taught the first week. And in the second week, we had a story from a student, Pervin Saket, which interpreted Sita as an alien. So it's Sita who's sent to Earth to figure out our propensity to create categories, right? To look at the life in terms of categories. And she's finally put to the test whether she's pure or not, she's virtuous or not. And then she kind of decides it's a hopeless case. And she pulls the contact off. She cuts the contact off, alien contact off. But this story is so different. It was a completely different take on the Ramayana epic that I had read and the stories that I had read around it, that it struck me that something new was being said. And I wondered whether we could have other stories that could be inspired, loosely inspired by the Ramayana. Not necessarily interpretations, not necessarily based on it, but kind of inspired by the gentle story. And I approached Vandana and I approached Urvashi at Zuban Books, and they're all game for this. Madly. because it's a very sensitive topic as such. The Ramayana is a very important book for the people, for Hindus especially. And to consider it as a fiction, as in purely fictional context, was a sensitive issue.
Although I should say that, in a sense, there is a tradition, India being India, that there's historically not just one Ramayana, but many, many Ramayanas.
Absolutely.
And even when I first heard the epic from my grandmother, she added her own bits of village lore and things like that to it. So it's something that's not meant to be static.
Right. There are lots of countertellings, actually.
Right.
I think in the Jain version, Ravan is the hero and Rama is the villain, actually, because they didn't like the Hindus at that time. There are Muslim versions, there are feminist versions. This was absolutely fascinating. And we thought we'd have a speculative fiction version of it.
Yeah, so in a sense, we are just keeping with the tradition.
in fact, we are being good Hindus.
There's nothing more traditional than breaking tradition.
Right, absolutely.
And how did it go? I mean, how was it soliciting?
Yeah, so we wanted to make an international anthology. So we sent out invitations all over the place. We solicited stories. We also it was an open call. So we got a lot of stories, actually. I think like something like 60, 70 stories.
Yeah.
And we picked 21, finally. And we have people from Israel, people from Holland, people from the US, from France, from all over the place. And most of the writers, of course, are from India. We have one from Thailand too, actually.
Yeah.
And the story, we loved it, and we got some great stuff. For example, we have a cyberpunk version of the story by Lavi Tidar, based on the Ramayana, right?
Nice.
And I think it's the first time ever in 2,500 years, you know. So it's about time.
And I think, well, I should say that Anil did the majority of the work, you know, especially doing the going through the initial submissions and narrowing them down, and then we sort of split the work between us and went through the final ones. And it was a really interesting task to see all the variations on the theme, you know, and particularly one of the stories. Well, all the stories stand out to me in some way, but we actually had one story written in one of the many Indian English vernaculars.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And you know, whereas one way of looking at a story written in that particular sort of dialect of Indian English would be to say, oh, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong usage of X, Y, and Z. But on the other hand, it was very real and alive because that's how many, many people speak out there. So we took the story.
In fact, yeah, we were very, very worried, right? We talked a lot about it, whether we should, this is bad English or this is, that is one kind of English. And finally decided that this is the way people are talking and might as well have a story in that diction.
So we minimally edited it just for, so that everyone could understand what was being said for clarity. But it's really cool. And I think, Anil, you mentioned in your intro that it has the best
last line. The best ending. Yeah. Of all the stories, it's got my favorite ending.
Excellent.
So there were some great experiences throughout. We still think that it's actually a preliminary work in the sense that we need a lot more anthologies of that sort. Kind of explore. This is just a kind of a start.
Yeah, and in fact, the first anthology that we thought about, which we realized would take a lot more work, would be an anthology of Indian science fiction. And you know, there are 18 languages in India other than English, and several of them have science fiction traditions, or maybe not several, but at least a good handful, like Marathi, Tamil,
Bengali.
Particularly Bengali, Hindi.
Yeah.
What we wanted to do was to get translators and find some of these gems that were sort of, you know, that the rest of the world, including us if we didn't speak that particular language, were deaf to, and put it all together in an anthology. And in fact, Anil, you went on this epic journey through
India. It was like a Darwinist journey, you know, questing for finches, you know.
Right.
I didn't speak most of the languages, so I was basically talking to people who spoke the languages, and they were not familiar with science fiction, right? So I'd explain science fiction. And they'll say, oh yeah, robots, Asimov, right? They'll say, no, Asimov is not a Bengali writer. You
know? right.
But the interesting thing is, I think you found, and it's something that I've experienced myself in India, is that people are quite, these genre divisions are like traffic in Delhi.
Yeah.
There's meant to be suggestions, like traffic rules.
Exactly. So it's all over the place, right?
Uh-huh.
You'd find maybe fantasy in history section, you know. It's perfectly fine. But my favorite discovery was this, that the first English work published in India, the first story, English story in India, was actually a speculative fiction story.
Really?
And the title is, I forget the author's name, it's actually some Bose. And the title of the story is A Day in the Year 1941. And it was written in 1841.
Neat.
And he's looking at 100 years span, and he's predicting the end of the British Empire. And this is a guy who's a patriot, and he's being sentenced to death. And the patriot tells the British officer, I'm the last, traitor you will hang, you know? And India got its independence a few years later, actually.
Right.
Talking about prediction.
Yeah.
1947.
That was awesome.
That nailed it a little closer than average for science fiction.
So he was Toru Dutt's uncle. And Toru Dutt was a French-Indian poet. She wrote poems in French. She was a multiple languages. So there was nice discoveries like that. There were also people we found in the late 19th century who performed a role somewhat similar to ours, actually, in the sense that they were kind of interpreting the world, the Indian world, to the Western audiences. So there was this guy, Gupta. He lived in Britain, and he would wear these fantastic Indian costumes, right? So he'd do these performances, and he's actually an Englishman. He's more English than English, right? But he would wear these costumes, and he'd go out there, and he would perform. He was the prince of somebody, right? And then he would perform these fantasy pieces. He would write these fantasy pieces. So there were all these characters, curious characters we found in the records, you know.
And I think, though, that it's not just that we want to bring this out to the world, but it's also we want to bring it out for ourselves, because I would like to be in dialogue as an SF writer with, science fiction in Malayalam.
Yeah.
The first Bengali science fiction writer I read, thank goodness there was a translation, Premendra Mitra, just blew me away. And the interesting thing about it was that I found that he was affecting my approach to science fiction as well, so that in a way I was finally, in a sense, although I've done it in other ways before, in dialogue with one of my own traditions. And I think it's very, very valuable to do that, to see how Tamil science fiction can affect, say, Bengali science fiction, can affect science fiction written in India in English, and then beyond to the world.
Yeah, in fact, I think you introduced me to Premendra Mitra. You had mentioned the author and I read the stories, and yeah, he's wonderful. There's a prof at IIT Kanpur, one of our friends, Sujitra Mathur, and she's got this theory that Indian science fiction breaks into three main traditions. She's been writing a book on it, actually. And the three traditions are, the first is derivative. You look at Western patterns and you write versions of it, right? So the Asimov type stories. And this has been there since the late 19th century. The second type is nationalistic. So you see in science something to improve India, right? Mm-hmm. And you get more and more like, this is what India of the future is going to be. It's going to be very scientific. They're going to get rid of superstitions, right? And it's a kind of an Indian version of science. And the third tradition, which he finds most interesting, and which I think Premendra Mitra speaks to, is subvert science. So it actually puts science, it makes kind of fun of it. It's kind of whimsical, right?
Yeah.
It takes the laws kind of like, another set of fantasy rules, right?
Okay.
So science is another kind of god. So it kind of subverts what we understand by science. And there's always this whimsical thread running through it.
And, you know, the great film director Satyajit Ray also wrote science fiction. And some of his stories, many of which are now out in translation, are very playful in a sort of similar way, you know, because the scientist in the story, the one who travels through space, Professor Shonku, is very gung-ho about science and so on, and is generally right about the things he wants to do, but he's still poking fun at him all the time. And it's just a very, you know, even the story by Jagdish Chandra Bose, who's one of the world's great scientists, only now beginning to be better known for his scientific contributions. He wrote a story in the late 1800s in Bengali, and I haven't yet come across a translation. It's about a cyclone, a huge storm, and about how the solution to that is in a bottle of hair oil.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, you'll be very glad to know that I got a perfect translation for it.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a beautiful translation. In fact, one of the students at the IIT Kanpur, we were telling this story to him, and we were complaining as usual that there's no translation. And he finally got sick of it, and he's a Bengali, and he finally sat down and did a translation, right? Uh-huh. And it's like one of those proper academic translations.
Bodhisattva?
Bodhisattva.
Okay.
It's a proper scientific translation. It's got footnotes, and it's got references, and it's got this old Bengali means this, and the new Bengali means that, right? And it's beautiful, and you're right. The interesting thing in those two, he said that there are two versions of the story. And the basic story is that there's this guy, it starts with something like a quote from Scientific American, that is, they're expecting a storm, and these guys are leaving on a trip to Sri Lanka, and en route they encounter this typhoon, right? Mm-hmm. And this guy remembers his kid had given a bottle of hair oil because he's going bald. So he remembers that you can pour oil on troubled waters, right? And he pours the oil, and lo and behold, the storm dissipates. One of the earliest examples of the butterfly effect, right?
Ah, okay.
Right? Something like 60 years before A Sound of Thunder. But the interesting part was that Bose, it's written for a hair oil competition.
Oh.
The reason you find the hair oil is because Bose, the submission condition was, you can write about anything as long as you mention the guy's product. Which happened to be a bottle of hair oil, right? So this famous scientist threw in hair oil there. But in a later version, when he was collecting it for his life's work, he decided that this is a little too flimsy, right?
Uh-huh.
And he comes up with a different version of how this oil ends up in this guy's suitcase. And that version is actually fantasy. It goes into things like there's a magic spell, and there's a sadhu had given this guy this magic bottle. The science is actually taken out. So in the first version is very scientific, and it's all about, you know, this kind of scientific effect, scientific phenomena in which small effects can have major consequences, right? But in the second version, he actually goes back to an older, like this is kind of a more mystical kind of story, right?
He was a very interesting man. And, you know, I think he basically sort of made science his own.
Yeah.
And
maybe you should mention his name. Yeah. Jagdish
Chandra Bose.
Yeah.
And you know, my little write-up on the translations in SF is the first paragraph is about him. And he was a very interesting man, and incredibly, you know, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about his scientific credibility. He made major advances, and now he's being recognized as one of the fathers of biophysics.
Yeah.
And he beat Marconi to research on radio waves, for instance. And yet he sort of made science his own thing.
Yeah.
You know what? I think the critic Upinder Mehan calls the domestication of technology by India, you know, so of science and technology by India. So India tends to, I don't know, how would you put it? India's like this big transformation process. You put something in, it's this sort of crazy creative mix of stuff, and something else comes out.
Yeah. It's hard to describe, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a kind of making it your own, right? At the same time, it's kind of leveling it with everything else. So nothing is allowed to exist one above the other. Right,
right. So in the same way, a lot of writers might mix fantasy and science fiction against this whole thing of, like, not taking borders too seriously.
Yeah, that's probably the truth. Yeah,
and divisions too seriously. Probably one of the iconic examples is something that a friend of mine told me, who lives in India and travels there and works for a travel magazine. And during one of her journeys, she went to a small town, and she found a shop that was selling the Indian drink lassi, which is a yogurt. You know, you churn yogurt sometimes with fruit juices and so on, and you make lassi. And these guys had figured out how to do it efficiently on a mass scale. They were making lassi in a washing machine.
Yeah, that's right. And,
that's what I call domestication of technology.
Yeah, this washing machine, like, churning out milk products, right?
Yeah, so the notion of, okay, a washing machine is for washing clothes. This is for making lassi. That is for doing something else. Those things don't, you know, they get mixed up. And I have hopes that Indian science fiction is, you know, as interesting a mix as that.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. So that was the kind of impetus which kind of pushes us. So we do these workshops. We're trying to do these workshop series in which we hold one workshop every year. And mostly schedules and financing and things like that prevent the, you know.
Of course.
But it's hopeful at this point.
Yeah, well, I think some of the most incredible science fiction I've read recently was back in that workshop in 2009 that we taught at, which was the first of its kind in India, at the Indian Institute of Technology in Kanpur, where most of the students hadn't actually written science fiction before.
Right.
And some of the most mind-blowing stories came from them.
Yeah.
So it's like,
in fact, the genre distinction is not that strong. So it's not strong yet. Let's put it that way. So the marketing hasn't gone into full force. So it's quite usual for mainstream authors to write a science fiction story, and vice versa.
Now, when you're talking about marketing, if you go into a bookshop somewhere in India, how are the books shelved? Are there the categories, or is it just all alphabetical by author?
The newer bookshops actually do have these categories now. Now they have Indian fiction, they have Western fiction, and they have, like, science fiction, right? Or science fiction is usually classified with mystery and things like that, right?
Yeah,
but they're beginning to form these categories.
Yeah, well, whereas the old bookstores, I remember,
right,
you know, was basically by author, you know,
right,
you just look for whatever author you want.
Yeah, in fact, I like to say Indian readers are typically, in English, are typically goats, because they will eat anything. They will read anything, right?
That's what I was like growing up, too.
Exactly, right? Everything would go into the mix.
Yeah.
So it's the whole thing of this being geek literature. This is not geek literature.
Right,
that doesn't
right.
exist.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
In fact, the word geek or nerd as a category didn't exist when I was in India, you know, as growing up there, going through college and everything like that. In fact, if you liked to learn, well, that was supposed to be a good thing.
Yeah.
People would look up to you.
Yeah.
And it didn't mean that you couldn't also like sports, you know. So again, there's that lack of like dividing or labeling things too much. So there's this whole sort of canvas of Indian science fiction, by which I simply mean science fiction emerging from India. I don't have any sort of loaded or any sort of particular categorization of set of assumptions or anything like that. Partly because I think India tends to sort of blow too much categorization anyway, and it's much more interesting when it's like this. What I'd like to see is Indian science fiction not only in dialogue with Western science fiction, but also with other science fictions from Asia. And we mentioned Thailand.
Yeah.
And do you have any other examples? It's not something I've had a chance to explore.
Yeah, in fact, in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. you find an interesting connection with Buddhist ideas. Because many of the Tamils have been living with Buddhists for a long time, right? So many of the rituals, many of the traditions, many of the stories have kind of like transferred between the two cultures.
So you're talking about Sri Lankan Tamil fiction?
Yeah. So, for example, I was talking to Marianne Mohan Raj, who has Tamil roots, Sri Lankan roots, and she was telling me that many of the stories that she had heard, right, were very different. They had more of a Buddhist flavor, right, than the versions that I was. We were talking about Ramayana, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are these cultural groups that we could be in a dialogue with, or if even for example, there's something like 500 years of Mughal influence,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So dialogue with Pakistan, or dialogue with Afghanistan, those elements are still there in the subcontinent.
Yeah.
The reason I mentioned the thing is because of Urdu. Recently, I don't quite remember how. I think I was like surfing the web and I encountered this website, and it's called the annuals of Urdu fiction, and it comes once a year, and it's this guy who Memon, who actually translates Urdu fiction into English, right? And I read this absolutely mind-blowing story by Nayar Masood. And it was called, if I remember correctly, Shisha Ghat, which means mirror place, right? Roughly, right? Shisha, mirror, mm-hmm. right? A glass place, right? And the story was mostly realist for the most part. It read like a regular mainstream story. Then there was this part where it actually slips into the, let's say, the irreal, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this girl who's getting off a boat. And instead of getting off under the water and her feet sinking, she actually just walks on the water. And that's just a small little scene and nothing else. There's no big fusses made of it, right? It's this kid looking at this girl getting off the boat and he's kind of infatuated with her, right? And she just walks on water, right? For that, maybe it'll make 3 seconds or 4 seconds. And it's not clear whether she's a surreal creature, whether she's out of this world or something has happened to her, right? And Urdu fiction, I discovered, has this unique problem or a unique gift, actually. They can't rely on the Hindu traditions, right? Because they're mostly, it's a Muslim, not necessarily, but by and large, it's Muslim speakers. So they kind of eschew the Hindu myths, and they don't work with the Hindu myths. They're not grown up with them, right? At the same time, if they want to, Islam kind of frowns on fantasy. Stuff that, maybe the Arabian Nights is fine, but the later stuff, it's a little difficult. You're a little careful as to what you fantasize on, right? So they have evolved this beautifully, they kind of a literature that walks between these two.
Huh.
It is surreal, at the same time, it plays the borderline between reality and irreality, right? So I've been reading a lot of Urdu fiction, and I've been finding that they do have a kind of a beautiful tradition. It's in the 1920s and 1930s. We find fantastic stories that we would today classify as speculative fiction, actually.
Wow.
They're slowly getting translated, you know, people now, like Surendra Prakash and...
Is that connected with the Dastan Goi tradition's revival? This is an oral tradition of storytelling that has been there for a long time and then died away, and then now modern writers and playwrights are reviving it.
Yeah.
Is there a connection?
That's more of the classical fantasy tradition, in which case you have like... for example, in that this Dastan, which is a kind of a tale, the long tale, right?
Right.
And Amir Hamza, the Dastan of Amir Hamza, is the story of Amir Hamza. And in that story, you find that there are the good guys and the bad guys, right? And the bad guys, it turns out, are the magicians. So in that world of that story, is actually magic, which is the villain. And the good guys never use magic. They always use their skills, they use their reason, they use their logic. They got technological tools, but they absolutely never use spells, right? So when you kill a magician, the whole heavens proclaim, oh, so-and-so magician is dead. And it's celebrated, right? So it's a fantasy which celebrates the death of magic.
Wow.
It's absolutely fascinating. Because the whole thing of they fits into the Islamic tradition in which you do not have sorcerers, right?
Right.
So there's some interesting little inversions that you find in the Urdu tradition, actually.
So I have some sense that that exists, and that's a beautiful part of that tradition.
Yeah, it is. The truth is, I don't think we really know. Even as Indians, we don't really know what's really in there, because there are so many languages and so much of it is buried. And you are really talking to people who really know the literature, right? That we are still in a process of finding out, actually.
Yeah. It's really a major project, which is why we had glibly thought, oh, we can like do research for a year and then publish this thing.
Yeah.
And then we found, boy, it's probably a lifetime's work to do this.
Now, are there academic centers or publishers that are acting as kind of gathering places?
I think there are, but it's isolated. And they're not working in concert.
Okay.
So there's this prof here who works on that prof who works on this, right?
Yeah.
They don't necessarily talk. One might be in women's studies, another might be in cultural programs, and they don't really necessarily talk, right? So there's that problem.
But then on the other hand, there are publishers like the Independent Press that has published both of us, actually, in New Delhi, Zuban. And they're descendants of India's first feminist press, Kali for Women. And they've been doing some groundbreaking work, and they're very, very interested in, in fact, they're publishing the Ramayana anthology, but they're very, very interested in bringing Indian SF together.
In fact, when I told Urvashi, when she said Zuban came from Kali for Women, it was an offshoot, I said, Kali for Women, I don't think you need that for women, you know? Kali is for women, right?
But actually, I have to say Anil's book, which is a YA book, but I think it's one of those books that defies categorization, was published by Zuban, and it's their one exception to publishing only women.
Yeah.
Because they liked it so much.
Yeah, I told Urvashi, I sent an email saying, I feel like a eunuch, a brand new eunuch in a harem, you know?
I've seen that with so many anthologies or so many publishers. They're like, we publish this kind of fiction, or
anthologies
this kind of fiction. And you find that one story, you're like, that doesn't fit your rules at all, but it's so good, I understand why you broke them.
Right. And hence the beast with 9 billion feet.
They're a remarkable outfit, actually. They publish all these wonderful works in nonfiction, fiction, right? And many of them are works of love, right? Labors of love. But they do it nonetheless, right?
Yeah, and much of it is volunteer-driven.
So yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
They're really amazing people.
Yeah,
thank God for volunteers in literature. If so many of us... I mean, if you actually tried to pay the people involved in this community minimum wage for what they love, they put into these things, nothing would ever
happen. I think half the battle is not to say you love it. Because if you say you love it, she'll do it for free, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Okay, but that's probably a good wrapping up spot for the conversation. I do want to give you both a chance to talk a little bit in conclusion about what you've got coming out. Now, obviously, you've got the novel coming out or soon that people should be looking for.
Yeah.
So, Anil?
Yeah, so I'm working on... The Beast of 9 Billion Feet came out in 2009. I'm working on a second novel, and hopefully that'll be out. I mean, I'll be done with it by September, and then I hope to shop it around and stuff like that. I don't have a title for it, but it's going to be out there.
And I don't have time to write the three novels that are in my head. But I'm working this summer on, I'm an academic and it's very hard, except in the summers. But I'm working this summer on two novellas that are destined for a couple of anthologies, and hopefully they'll find a home, and also for with a couple of short stories. I'm also trying to get some headway with my children's book. They're two in the series. This is Young Uncle Comes to Town, which was published here by Viking Penguin, and back in India by Zuban originally, and by Penguin India. So I've written two of those, and the third one is long overdue, and I've got some 10 odd chapters done.
Right.
So I'm hoping I might get to finish it. But that's about it for this summer anyway.
I understand. But thank you both so much
thanks,
for agreeing to talk to us, and hopefully we will talk again later.
Yeah.
Thanks.